When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome back to Game of Thrones 2 Electric Boogaloo. I'm your host, Anthony. This week, philosopher Jason Eberle joins me. In addition to being a medievalist interested in philosophy, he's an ethicist, so you'll hear a bit of both in this conversation.
And then after that, I'll include a short excerpt of my conversation with my friend Arthur Jamfa, where we talk about Tyrion's relationship to women in general.
A quick note, if you are interested in other podcasts that I do, you might be interested to know that Steve and I have changed our other podcast from the title Cocoons of Horror to Properly Howard, where we'll talk about all kinds of films. So if you're not into horror, come over and party with Steve and I over at Properly Howard, the Lorehounds, friends of the Bald Move community. They are now hosting Properly Howard. Okay, without further ado, here is Dr. Jason Eberle.
I wish I had time, at least right now, to reread all these books. But when I pick up, but this is what's great about Martin is I can pick up and read just like the chapter we're going to discuss. And I remember so many other things from some of the other chapters.
Because he's a master at creating touch points without naming other characters or whatever. Like this chapter absolutely, brings in the Jon Snow narrative without ever mentioning Jon Snow, right? Mm-hmm. He's just brilliant. He's brilliant at, the Renly Stannis thing. He doesn't tell you, mm-hmm. he doesn't actually show you the siege of Storm's End. All he does is use this chapter, and then the next time we see that the two brothers are doing a little parlay. So you don't actually see the siege happening. Just intricately told, these stories.
Yeah.
Let me read my synopsis of the chapter, and we can jump into it.
Sounds good.
After telling Cersei that Stannis and Renly are battling each other, Tyrion slips his sister a laxative. The next day, he sits on the Iron Throne and holds court. He sends Kleos Frey back to the Starks with the demand for fealty and the bones of Ned Stark. He dismisses Alistair Thorne's warning of zombies and sends him back to the wall with shovels and men to use them. After some scheming with Varys, Tyrion, Shagga, and Timmett interrogate Pycelle. Pycelle spills what he knows about Jon Arryn's death. Jason Eberle, what do you want to talk about today?
There's so much to unpack. It's always amazing to me rereading these chapters. Just how much George R. R. Martin packs into relatively short chapters, right? So I guess the first thing I would note is just how much deception is playing a role here. And I think this is true throughout the book. In terms of the series of books, this one may be my favorite.
The first book is really great. This one, it really seems to ascend. It almost takes the story up a notch.
Yeah. And then in terms of the television series, this will be the second season as well. I think, again, it's my favorite season because I think there's the most political scheming going on. I like the, Tyrion's machinations and Cersei's as well. Mm-hmm. Varys and Littlefinger, right? Things, change a lot. When they kind of all split up, right? and they all kind of go off to different places. So I like it when they're all here in King's Landing together, in the Red Keep scheming. But yeah, I mean, there's a great deal, again, of deception. Of course, we had the original deception involving John Arryn's death and everything that was involved in that, what he was hiding, Tyrion deceiving Cersei by slipping into the laxative, like you said. And then, of course, you know, to what extent can you ever trust anything Varys or Littlefinger says? And so this function of lying, right? A lot of philosophers, you know, talk about the ethics of lying, uh-huh. and you have everything from Immanuel Kant, who said you can't tell a lie even to save someone's life,
right?
To, you know, a consequentialist theorist who would say, you know, lying is not intrinsically right or wrong. It's the reason that you're doing it. It's your purpose. And is your purpose to produce better outcomes, better consequences?
Uh-huh.
Does
the consequentialist care about your motives, or does the consequentialist care about the outcomes of the act?
So I think, you know, there's range of consequentialists. I would say the sophisticated consequentialist cares about your motives insofar as those motives are aimed at
good outcomes,
a good outcome. Okay. So in other words, you know, there's things we talk about, moral luck, both good and bad luck.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, just sort of straight up consequentialist who literally only cares about the consequences would say, well, what if you're aiming to pursue your own ends, your own power, but that ends up helping to bring about something good and amazing? You know, you could say that, you know, various things that Littlefinger or Cersei or others do that are totally for their own ends actually end up serving Westeros better than they had anticipated. Other consequentialists, going back to say John Stuart Mill, who kind of brought in a little bit of virtue theory, right? With virtue theorists are concerned with, you know, the moral character of the agent, would say, no, you have to have the right motivations or the right character oriented towards maximizing the greatest good for the greatest number. And then whether you succeed or not, that's kind of up to fate, right? And maybe circumstances outside your control.
Yeah, yeah. So the virtue ethicist is very, very much interested in character. Like, mm-hmm. are you the type of person that'll run into a burning building out of instinct or something like that?
Exactly. And you might try to, and then something gets in your way and you're unable to do mm-hmm. it. So you didn't maximize the best consequences, but you were aiming towards that. You were trying to. And, you know, I think, you know, this is why I think Tyrion, both in the books and in Peter Dinklage's portrayal, is obviously, you know, a fan favorite, a character everyone warms to, because, of course, Tyrion has his own vices. He has his own self-interested motivations, but he is seemingly genuinely interested in what's best for Westeros.
Mm-hmm.
And not simply what's best for Tyrion, right?
I would say, I'm just gonna interrogate that a little bit.
My
feeling is Tyrion's interested in what's good for Tyrion. Number one, I think he's interested in what's good for the Lannisters as a clan. Number two, I think that he's interested in sort of what's good for the people of Westeros, number three. And this makes him unique in that for everyone, almost everyone else in the story, the people of Westeros are like number 10 on the list. so it's not like I'm not saying that he's self-interested necessarily in an immoral way. I'm saying that compared to everyone else in the story, He is quite interested in the common good, but self and family would definitely be higher on his priority list. What would you say to that?
No, I think that's fair, particularly Tyrion at this point in the story. I was kind of projecting a little bit, you know, towards further on in the story where
he kills his own father. that's not putting family first, right?
Right, exactly. And then You know, and then obviously that forces him to go into exile, but then that leads him to discover Daenerys and to bring her back, at least with the aim of this.
Yeah, in the show, that's what happens. And that's what we think is going to happen in the books. Yeah. So
exactly. So the point being is that, yeah, I mean, obviously characters develop. And so I think your ranking is perfectly fair, particularly at this point in Tyrion's development. Mm-hmm.
Here are the weekly highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
Apple TV is releasing a new series based on Blake Crouch's novel Dark Matter. Aaron and I are big fans of his work, so we're picking up the new show on day one. Join us this Wednesday for the preview podcast.
The Shogun Limited series might be over, but that doesn't mean our Shogun coverage has to end. We've got the wrap-up podcast releasing this Tuesday, where we'll consider all your feedback and final thoughts on a series. And because we like the show so much, we decided to go all the way back to 1980 to cover the first TV adaptation of the novel. Do what you can to find a copy and join us this Thursday for the first of our four-part podcast on the 1980 Shogun miniseries.
And finally, the latest first-run movie, The Fall Guy, features Emily Blunt and Ryan Gosling. He's a stuntman tasked with finding the star of his ex-girlfriend's movie when he suddenly goes missing. Is it a rom-com? Yes. Does that mean I'll automatically hate it? Not if the trailer lives up to its promise. Join us for the podcast on Bald Move Pulp this Thursday night.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off badass season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints, except it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim, order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar, then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of King's Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live.
We're about 10 weeks out from House of the Dragon Season 2, and it's time to prepare for war.
Which in our case means, well, watching a lot of Hot D and reading a lot of Fire and Blood.
Each week between now and June 16th, Maester Anthony and his co-host Steve are hosting a watch of each episode of Hot D Season 1. And then me and Jim are going to host a discussion of the differences between the events on that episode and how they're recounted in George R. R. Martin's historical tome, Fire and Blood.
That's right, I've resorted to reading dragon books. God help us all. We'll see if my fresh eyes add any new insights or predictions into Season 2.
Arm yourselves with all the lore you can for the battles ahead. House of the Dragon returns June 16th, but we've got you covered until then.
Check out all of our upcoming Hot D coverage on the Hot D feed or on Bald Move Pulp, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
I was going to ask you about his interaction with Cersei at the beginning of this chapter. Mm-hmm. I think that people have varying opinions about Cersei. I think most people view her as villainous. We can talk about the nature of her villainy later if we want to. But Tyrion lies to achieve over a villain in one view. What would the ethicist, and you can pick your ethicist, say to doing bad to someone who's bad? In other words, like, it can't be wrong to steal from a thief, something like that.
So, like I said, depends on the ethicist. So, you know, earlier I mentioned Immanuel Kant's take on lying, right? Where he says, you know, one can't tell a lie even to save, right, someone's life. Uh-huh. And of course, you know, the sort of classic counterexample is, you know, what if, you know, it's World War II, you're hiding Anne Frank and her family in your mm-hmm. attic, Gestapo knocks on your door, do you have any Jews in your house? And, you know,
Kant says, sorry, can't lie.
Yeah, yeah. And he actually gives a kind of consequentialist reasoning for saying it. He says, look, what if unbeknownst to you, you know, Anne Frank and her family sneaks out of your attic and they went to the house next door. So you lie and say, nope, no Jews in my house. So they go knock on the next door and boom, they catch the family, right? They wouldn't have caught them if you hadn't lied, right? And so Kant's saying, like, that's on you, right? You should have. So his take home point is, you should just do your moral duty no matter what. What's most important is your conscience is clean, yeah. right? Not what the outcome is. Now, another response to Kant's take.
And that would be some kind of expression of deontology.
Exactly. Right. Now, like I said, consequentialists would disagree with that, but also some fellow deontologists. And one of the responses is to say the Gestapo doesn't deserve the truth. That yes, we ought not to lie to people who deserve the truth. And if, you know, you have these murderous villains and so on, they don't deserve the truth. They're not worthy of being treated as moral agents equivalent to the rest of us who are not murderous, you know, lying villains ourselves. And so that point about, you know, yes, Cersei obviously has her self-interested machinations. And honestly, at this point, kind of as you were noting before, at this point in the story of the character development, it's just a battle of wills between Tyrion and Cersei, right? They're both kind of vying for their father's love and affection, in a sense. They're both trying to prove themselves to Tywin. And they both want power and exercise power. And of course, a lot of that is through the manipulation of Joffrey. And this is kind of a side note, but one of the things I love in this chapter, there's all sorts of examples of Tyrion manipulating people by understanding them and giving them what they want to serve his end. So, example, giving Joffrey the crossbow to distract him so he won't be sitting on the Iron Throne. Therefore, Tyrion gets to sit on the Iron Throne and exercise power in his hand.
Right.
So Tyrion's so good at manipulating people, as is Cersei. At this point, I think it's not even so much giving. I don't know if there's a proper ethical analysis of at least what Tyrion's doing, because I think both of them are just exercising what Nietzsche would call their will to power.
Okay. My sense is that most people would say something like, yeah, big deal. If you do something unethical to someone who's fundamentally villainous, what is the big deal for that? But I think most folks are unhappy with, let's say, the example of like dirty cops. Mm-hmm. And you could make the argument that, well, you know, these dirty cops are skimming money off of, you know, drug deals that happen. What's the big deal? Everyone in this world of the drug deal, most people would have a problem with that. Most people would say, no, we need our cops to sort of live up to a standard of ethics. They kind of have to be deontologists. We don't want consequentialist cops.
Right.
So I think even folks who sort of spout the consequentialist line on these things kind of are selective. So I guess to bring it back to Cersei, what's Cersei's chief sin? Well, you could say she's a pedophile. I mean, factually, she's engaging in incest.
Mm-hmm.
but Lancel's barely 16. And she's manipulated him to, you know, get what she wants, whether that in terms of sort of carnal desire or just having a political ally or whatever. But she's basically manipulated her 16-year-old cousin, right?
Mm-hmm.
So in comparison, Tyrion withholds the truth from her and gives her a bad case of the runs. Like, so I think most people would be like, yeah, I'm not going to fault Tyrion for that. He's doing this to Cersei. She's a villain. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I feel like there's limits to how we view these things.
Yeah, I certainly agree with you that most people would think there are limits. And I'm not even sure. I mean, I think the reason that sort of the big three ethical theories that we always talk about in intro philosophy classes, right? Deontology, consequentialism, or utilitarianism, and then virtue ethics is because, yeah, I think most, you know, people who never study philosophy just intuitively buy into some aspect of each mm-hmm. of these theories. And, you know, I think by and large are a bit inconsistent how we apply them, right? We're kind of consequentialist about some things and deontologist about others and so on. But I do think in this particular example, you know, from the dirty cop example to talking about Tyrion, Cersei here, that really, I think the lens is virtue theory, because the idea is if you do certain types of bad things or even things that might be permitted under, you know, one set of circumstances, but it cultivates this character. So again, Comte wasn't a virtue theorist, but going back to his example of lying to even save someone's mm-hmm. life, you could think of a Kantian virtue theorist saying, well, look, you might lie for this good, noble purpose now, but that might just make you more prone to telling other lies about less dire circumstances, to then maybe even lying in ways that serve your own self-interest. And so it's about cultivating this habit, right? That's what virtues are, or vices for that matter, right? These are habitual inclinations of patterns of thinking and behavior that we sort of self-justify to ourselves. Oh, this is okay. You know, this isn't a morally bad thing. And right. So I think that, so the idea being that Tyrion is a liar, as is Varys, Littlefinger, Cersei, right? They all have the vice of being dishonest.
I mean, okay, yes. However, I think Tyrion's a great talking point on this, because I think that Tyrion actually enjoys telling the truth. He happens to be a good liar, but he also has this sort of like wicked glee when he says the truth when no one else in the room, you know, will say it, because it's a sort of a polite, people prefer polite lies or whatever. And mm-hmm. Tyrion likes to upset that kind of apple cart. So I don't know if it's necessarily like he gets perverse glee over deceiving. I think he gets even more glee out of sort of revealing. He happens to be good at lying at the same time.
No, I think that's a very interesting point. And I'm just thinking of this passage here from the chapter where he says, so I'll just read this brief passage. Littlefinger stroked his beard. Do you truly mean to send away all your guards, Lannister? Tyrion, no, I mean to send away all my sister's guards. The queen will never allow that. Oh, I think she may. I am her brother. When you've known me longer, you'll learn that I mean everything I say.
Especially the lies.
Even the lies? Especially the lies. Right? And, you know, but the idea meaning that Tyrion's lies are purposeful. You know, there are people who are pathological liars, kind of like there are people, you know, we call them kleptomaniacs, who are pathological thieves, right?
Yeah. I think there's that scene, they lie with no purpose. I don't know if you've seen, everyone's seen this. In Infinity War, you've got this sort of exchange between Thanos and Loki. Mm-hmm. And Loki's like, why would I lie? And Thanos says, well, I would imagine it's like breathing for you, right?
Yes.
A great example of like, yeah, maybe Loki doesn't need a reason to lie. He's just a trickster. And that's what tricksters do, right?
Exactly. And so taking Tyrion at his word here, he is the anti-Loki. Yes, he lies, but he always lies intentionally with a purpose, whether right. you know we can ethically justify that purpose or not.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Yeah.
I like that passage for sure. I mean, I kind of always like it when Varys and Tyrion are sort of exchanging wit and wisdom. I think early on you said something along the lines of like, you know, you sort of listed off all the people at court and they're all kind of liars. I sometimes wonder about Varys. Like, I don't know. I think Varys is usually pretty honest with Tyrion. And I don't know if he's honest with everyone like that, but in this book especially, I feel like Varys is pretty much an open book when it comes to Tyrion. I think he views Tyrion as something of an ally, or maybe he's trying him on to see if he'll be a good ally. But I don't get the sense that Varys is trying to deceive Tyrion.
No, that's a good point. Not only about Varys' relation with Tyrion, but just maybe, I mean, even broader. Yeah, I'm rethinking, you know, how much does Varys with anyone actually lie, right? Varys, right? He's the master whispers. He has little birds, right? Who feed him information, right? Varys trades in truth, right? Now he hides truth a lot. So you know, there's obviously a big, you know, debate about is not revealing a truth a deception versus just telling a falsehood. Yeah, I would agree that not only with Tyrion, but maybe even more broadly, I don't know if Varys is actually that dishonest in terms of telling people falsehoods all the time versus gathering information, holding it, and revealing it strategically.
And he's helping Tyrion sort of deceive the general public. You know, he's sort of set up this system for Tyrion to go into the brothel and then, you know, all of his disguises so Tyrion can kind of keep Shay a secret, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you could say that Varys' entire persona may be a mummer's farce, right? He's practiced in acting, and actors are really good at creating an illusion. We don't really know what Varys' motives are. And so he's really good at concealing the truth on the macro level. But I do get the sense that on the micro level, for Tyrion at least, he seems like he's pretty much an ally.
And of course, you know, in the show, we see how their relationship evolves. It also speaks to, you know, this other notion that, you know, everyone needs a friend in the sense that Aristotle meant, like a true friend of virtue, someone that you can be completely open and honest with, you can truly be yourself with, who seeks your good as you seek their good. You know, Cersei and Jaime, right? That's their relationship. And, you know, Daenerys and, well, various people throughout the story, right? Kind of evolves as people disappear and die.
Daenerys and Missandei seem to have that kind of relationship. Does Aristotle say everyone needs a friend of virtue, or does he think it's relatively rare?
Well, he says both. He says to be truly happy, you need at least one, if not a few, of these types of friendships, but he does also say they're extremely rare.
So maybe it's pretty rare to be truly happy.
It's pretty rare to be truly happy because there's a risk. Because in these types of friendships, right, it's mutual self-giving to the other. My happiness is bound up in what makes you happy and vice versa. You know, the purest form of this might be something like the parent-child relationship, you know, where you have truly unconditional love. And the child's happiness and well-being is, you know, part of what constitutes the parent's happiness. That's a different type of relationship than friendship, but it's analogous to this type of thing.
It is asymmetrical, though, I feel like.
Oh, the parent-child is asymmetrical, for sure.
I think I've covered this on the pod, but it might have been like a few years ago. What are Aristotle's three levels of friendship, just for folks who are not up to speed?
Yeah, so you have friendships of pleasure, just people you enjoy hanging out with, people your drinking buddy, right? Something like that. You know, the people you play Dungeons and Dragons with on Sunday night. Then there's friendships of utility.
I think he would almost view utility as sort of a more basic form. Like you go to the butcher, you have good business relationships or something like that. And pleasantness would be sort of a higher level, would you say?
Yeah, you're right. In the order he presents them, utility does come first, then pleasure. Yeah. The barista who I chit-chat with every time I get my coffee, uh-huh. right? Versus me and that barista now go and start hanging out together and going to movies, so they both enjoy sci-fi, right? To then, we really, truly care about each other, and we form this, deep friendship of virtue. Uh-huh. That's going to be very rare.
So I would say, all right, so it's just for an example here. I do think that Varys and Tyrion are kind of at that basic utility level. I think that for whatever reason, they've decided we both need an ally in the city. You're pretty smart. And so far, you've proven trustworthy. Let's mutually use each other for selfish benefit. I think that there's something about that. But I think that there's almost an aspiration. I feel like Tyrion almost views Varys as someone that I kind of enjoy my talks with him. Mm-hmm. I think Tyrion almost views us as anyone who can kind of match wits with him. I think mm-hmm. he sort of gets pleasure from that.
Oh, absolutely. And again, there aren't, no pun intended, stark bright lines in between these three types of friendships.
Right. Yeah. You can build on these things.
Exactly. And of course, and that's the thing too, like in the friendship of virtue, that friendship could bring great utility to your life and ought to be pleasurable, right? So I agree with you. I think, especially at this point of the story, it's primarily a friendship of utility that they both at some level take some pleasure insofar as they're both able to be honest about themselves with each other. That's kind of the seed of that friendship of virtue. It's not there yet, but the seed is kind of there.
I was just going to ask, can you think of anyone in this entire series of novels that is an example of a friendship of virtue? I was thinking of John and Sam.
Mm.
Otherwise, hard to find.
Yeah, it is hard to find. I think, and partly because a lot of these relationships aren't that long lasting.
Uh-huh.
I think at some level, Brienne and Jaime sort of evolve that type of relationship.
Yeah, they do have. Yes, I'm be very interested to see what happens with that friendship. Because they kind of start out as sort of frenemies, right?
Yeah, exactly.
They both kind of respect each other. They both kind of need each other to survive. But, that's really... And maybe Brienne and Kat, but even so, it's like how well... Again, asymmetrical... Mm-hmm. Mutual appreciation... What about Renly and Loras? What do you think about Renly and Loras being sort of a friendship of virtue?
To be perfectly honest, I'd have to delve back into how deeply the book describes their relationship.
Does not describe it with any. I mean, but there is something about
so not much better than the show.
Oh, right? Even worse than the show. It's sort of all hinted. Yeah.
So then it seems more just like maybe the pleasure they take in each other.
Yeah, I mean, Renly laughs at Loras's jokes and sort of enjoys his company. We're not really told, that they're, how virtuous their friendship is in terms of like, does Loras make Renly a better king? Does Renly make Loras a better knight? Are they both sort of iron sharpening iron until they are both better people? We don't really know that.
Yeah. And again, that could all even be at the level of utility, right? The other example that just came to mind would be Ygritte and Jon Snow.
Okay.
Obviously, there's a turn in that relationship, but...
I don't think Aristotle would have considered any kind of romantic interest along his scale of friendship, but... of course, we know better than Aristotle at this point, right?
Well, that's true. I mean, the romance side is almost kind of an aside thing. Like it could be there or not be there, right? But it's not essential to any of these relationships. Right. But no, it's not even so much the romance. As I always just think of, you know, obviously Ygritte's famous line, "You know nothing, Jon mm-hmm. Snow." She's always trying to make Jon Snow a better person.
Right. Huh.
She really is kind of interested in his, you know, survival among, you know, the wildlings. Uh-huh. and she's trying to help him to integrate.
It is interesting to me that Jon Snow seems to be at the center of these conversations. Because I was just thinking, like, maybe Jon and Tormund get to some level, but there's some level of John's sort of inability to, I don't want to say be self-interested, but he's sort of like, all of John's emotions are on the surface. You almost always know what John is up to, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And there's a vulnerability that's attached to that. And it's almost this person is risking showing me his true self. Maybe it's actually worth making friends with this person. Whereas I feel like, you know, Tyrion, for all of his sort of singularity and his loneliness, his cynicism does not allow him to show his true self to too many people. And mm-hmm. so for someone like Tyrion to establish a true friend is going to be almost impossible. I don't know, maybe Tyrion and Jaime.
Yeah.
Interesting. I always love talking about Varys whenever I get a chance. I'm sort of,
oh yeah,
I'm a big Varys fan. I don't think he's a villain, but I might be wrong.
We'll just have to see.
One thing that Tyrion is, I mean, talk about consequences. Totally dismissive of Alistair Thorne. And given, as readers, we know the macro story. We know that this is a story of ice and fire. And here we have, you know, sort of a portent of the ice magic. And Tyrion, of course, he's worried about being embarrassed in court. So he goes on the offensive and embarrasses Alistair Thorne so that he can save face. This is all sort of rearranging deck chairs on the Titanic.
Who's going to send, you know, playing the Game of Thrones, who's going to send to the Iron Throne of a kingdom that is potentially doomed? Right.
I mean, what does Alistair Thorne want from this exchange, do you think?
I mean, he wants, you know, he wants help, right? To, you know, he sees the danger. He obviously doesn't understand how huge this danger is. No one at this point understands the army that is right beyond the wall, but there's a power that they can understand, right? So it's not even like, because Tyrion gives them more men.
Yeah, if he wants again, like men, said, he gets more men. There's no doubt about that.
Right, but it's almost, but he wants more than that. I mean, he probably wants, you know, the Grand Maester to step in and be like, we need to study this. Yeah, we're going to devote all of our resources, right? We're going to devote our best science, you know, and their, you know, Westerosi understanding of science.
In the meantime, let's send all the armies that are warring against each other up to the wall. You know, I think that would be the best case scenario, which is absolutely not going to happen.
Right. And of course, right. And that's, you know, the complicated nature of not only stories as a whole, but particularly in this book, because this is the Clash of Kings, right? This is where you have the maximal disunification, uh-huh. right, among all the kingdoms. And yeah, what does Alistair Thorne want? Without it maybe even consciously knowing it, he wants unity. He wants the seven kingdoms united to fight this new, bigger threat that even he doesn't know how big it is. But he's scared.
Right.
He's a brave, you know, warrior, but he's scared of this unknown, ununderstandable threat that, to, you know, this day has only been the stuff of children's stories and nightmares, right? It's the idea, like, you know, take the worst nightmare, the worst, you know, fantasy evil that we've ever been told in our mythology and so on, and then you discover actual evidence that it's real.
right.
Yeah.
Well, in addition to that, you know, Alistair Thorne was once a man of court, right? He was a lord or a knight or something under the Targaryen reign. Mm-hmm. I don't think he likes being made a joke of. And so, of course, he has to sort of lend the seriousness to the cause, or else he seems like a joke himself.
No, that's a good point. Yeah, that his own need to save face for himself. You know, he talks about how he was been basically treated dishonorably when he arrived. And part of that, it's a mix, right? It's a mix of the urgency of the message he needs to relay, but also, yeah, his own pride.
Well, and here's an example of Tyrion telling a lie not for any kind of virtue, not for a greater outcome. You know, he says, "Bronn, this is not well done. This is an old friend of mine. How could you let him, you know, sit for weeks without an audience?" In reality, he wants to embarrass Alistair Thorne, who sort of to get back at him for their exchanges up at the wall. This is just revenge, basically.
Yeah. Yep.
Hey, it's time for another season of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? The premise is simple. A Gen Xer and a millennial watch old 80s action TV to see what still works and what doesn't. In previous seasons, we've done podcasts for Knight Rider, Airwolf, MacGyver, A-Team, and more. However, this year we're doing a very special season of Feeny. We're going back and reviewing the very special episodes of 80s and 90s sitcoms. Come cringe along with us as Hollywood tries to warn our families of the dangers of underage smoking, drug abuse, alcoholism, eating disorders, and much more. We start out with the episode of Boy Meets World where a high school kid gets sucked into a cult. Worlds collide as the Mr. Feeny finally makes an appearance on Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Join me and my buddy Jay each week for episodes full of nostalgia and secondhand embarrassment. And don't worry, if Very Special isn't your speed, we've also got some all-time classic Knight Rider episodes to close the season with. Find Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Each Wednesday on Bald Move Pulp, starting April 3rd.
Jason, let me ask you maybe a question that's discipline specific.
Mm-hmm.
The practice of ex cathedra, this is when the Pope actually speaks with divine voice,
mm-hmm.
You know, from the seat of power, I guess. Is that a concept that had political currency? And like, for instance, it seems like in this chapter, Tyrion is ex cathedra in a sense.
Mm.
Or is that something that was specific to the Catholic Church?
I mean, I think the idea of the ruling monarch, whoever it is, you know, speaking from a throne, right? Whether it's, you know, we just had this, you know, major coronation ceremony for, you know, King Charles III now, right?
Uh-huh.
And not that he sits on the throne, you know, right? It's only ceremonious that he sits on the throne. And of course, you know, the British monarch's power is not what it was. But in terms of what I think is influencing George R.R. Martin, I do think it's a combination of just the power, the temporal power that medieval monarchs would wield. But then someone also thinking, because of course religion is mixed up with the political forces in Westeros, right? And you have relationships like that in the medieval church. The notion of the Catholic Pope speaking ex cathedra, which is Latin for from the chair, from the seat.
Right.
It refers specifically to the chair of St. Peter, who was, you know, one of the original 12 apostles.
Who's thought to be by tradition, the first pope, right?
Exactly. So the pope is understood as the vicar of Christ, right? He's the successor of Peter the apostle, but he represents Christ on earth. And the notion of the Pope speaking sort of with this sort of infallible authority, mm-hmm. ex cathedra, it's actually a relatively new idea.
Oh, okay.
In the church. Yeah. It is tied to politics to a certain extent. It came about at the First Vatican Council. A lot of people may have heard of Vatican II that happened in the 1960s. This was the previous council back in the 1860s.
Okay. So this is a bishops... modern concept.
It's a modern concept and was happening at a time when the Catholic Church was losing its temporal power because you had this region of Italy known as the Papal States.
Uh-huh.
And what happened in the mid-18th centuries, you had King Vittorio Emanuele unifying Italy. So the modern country of Italy we know today only came about 150, 160 years ago. Uh-huh. And part of what happened is they conquered those papal lands and stripped the Pope of his temporal power. So it was kind of like the assertion of papal infallibility in matters of faith and morals, right, would say, okay, you might have the temporal power, but I still have this power, right, you know, over religious things. Yeah.
So, yeah, I guess probably an anachronism on my part, but I thought that this sort of maybe stemmed from the idea that whoever is sitting in the chair seems to have more authority. Like, even the king's words carry more when he's sitting on the throne or something like that.
I mean, the throne is symbolic, and of course, in Game of Thrones, we have a literal throne, right? The Iron Throne. Yeah. The chair of St. Peter, if you go to St. Peter's Basilica in the Vatican, there is this giant chair at the back of the basilica that is the chair of Peter, but the Pope doesn't ever actually sit in that chair, right? Mm-hmm. The chair is ethereal, it's symbolic, mm-hmm, and the authority goes with the person who is elected Pope, and he carries that authority as Pope. So it's not like anyone would sit, quote, in the Pope's chair and wield the Pope's authority.
Right.
In fact, when the Pope dies, there's a particular cardinal, the dean of the College of Cardinals, who kind of takes over running day-to-day operations, right, at the Vatican until the new Pope is elected. But his authority is very limited. It's not like he gets to play Pope until the new Pope's elected. He's got this kind of limited caretaker authority as, quote, you know, kind of like the hand of the Pope. So Tyrion, as hand of the king, has much more power and authority, especially when he is sitting on the Iron Throne, as we see in this chapter.
Yeah, I think that you could view Tyrion as, well, you're kind of temporary because, you know, Tywin's going to show up eventually and take his place as hand of the king. Or you could view him as, well, you're not the actual king. My sense is, though, if you're sitting in the Iron Throne, it just has the authority of the Iron Throne. It's like the office itself has authority. And I don't really know if that's true. I don't really know if it's like, well, it's symbolic in the way that, you know, that you said that the Pope's chair is symbolic. But maybe there's no sort of like, well, those are the rules. It was said from the chair. It must be the law now. I'm not sure how to understand the authority.
Yeah, I think it's kind of something in the middle. I think the Iron Throne is largely symbolic, like the Pope's chair, except that the fact that it is a throne that people do actually sit on. But you have to have the rightful authority to sit there, right? Uh-huh. So in other words, let's say if you know, Sansa Stark snuck in at night and jumped into the Iron Throne. It's not like she could wield pronouncements that would be binding on all of the Westerosi, right?
Right.
You know, Tyrion gets the right to sit in the Iron Throne as the hand of the king. And later we see, you know, Tywin as well, uh-huh, when he takes over his hand. We saw Ned Stark when he was hand. So it does seem pretty limited to the king,
right,
or queen, when in the case of Cersei later,
right,
on,
right,
or
the hand,
or the hand,
because we saw Ned do it in the first book.
Yep.
He sat on the Iron Throne and said, you know, sent out Dondarrion to take down the mountain or whatever, and it was, you know, everyone basically had to follow those orders as if he was the king. I did note, however, that, you know, Alistair Thorne's kind of being mocked in this chapter, and he waits until Tyrion descends before he really kind of retorts in kind. You know, it's sort of, he has some sort of respect for the office, but then as soon as Tyrion's down at the bottom, you know, I didn't come here to be insulted by the likes of you. You know, that's sort of the tone. And I think that there's something about, well, I got to wait till that guy's not sitting there before I actually speak my mind.
No, I think that's a good point. I do think that, again, given, even if it's not the sitting in the chair that gives Tyrion the authority, when he's sitting in the chair exercising his office as hand, that is different than when he's just Tyrion Lannister.
Right.
And his descending from the throne is symbolic of that. I mean, I would suspect that you know, for example, if Tyrion had like dismissed the rest of the court, it's an empty throne room, but for whatever reason, he's still choosing to sit in the chair. Ser Alistair might still have talked to him the way he did, just because at that moment, sitting in a chair or not sitting in a chair, he's no longer functioning in court as the hand of the king.
Right. Huh.
Yeah.
All right. So what else struck you by this chapter?
So the last major thing, you know, event in the story is, of course, the exchange with Grandmaster Pycelle.
Right.
Right. Where, you know, they catch him with the young girl, send her away.
Tyrion's canary trap finally sort of has an outcome.
Mm-hmm.
He learns that Pycelle is the one who spilled the beans.
Yeah. And again, that was a very effective use of deception because yeah, he tells three different things to three different people. And only one of them's the truth. And so again, consequentialist very much approving of Tyrion's methodology here.
Right. Okay. So he decides, all right. So then he goes, we learned something new about Pycelle, right? He's clearly not the dotard that he always pretended to be. Mm-hmm. He's got a young woman in his bed who Shaga falls in love with immediately.
Or at least falls in lust.
Yeah, right. We don't know how into virtue ethics Shaga is, right? So, and then I guess we get some sort of confirmation on a number of plots that were introduced in the first novel, right?
Mm-hmm.
Pycelle sort of confirms that, you know, Jon Arryn found out about Cersei, and so then someone had Jon Arryn killed, and who was it? Well, you know, who did the poisoning? Maybe it's Pycelle, Tyrion thinks, and then sort of Jon Arryn points to Hugh of the Vale, who we knew, you know, who was Jon Arryn's squire, and who conveniently gets killed by the mountain at the tournament, right? It's a very neat cover up. The murder was done in public with everyone watching, and you know, with plausibly like, well, the mountain lance slipped or something like that.
So the other interesting thing that jumps out at me in this scene, and it's actually a theme throughout this entire chapter, is the idea of humiliation, whether public or private. Mm. Again, Tyrion, you know, given his physical stature, has basically been humiliated his entire life, right?
Yeah, he's no stranger to humiliation.
He's no stranger to humiliation. So he does, you know, enjoy using humiliation as a tool. So he drugs Cersei, you know, like you said, gives her a laxative, gives her the runs. All he needed was incapacitate her. He could have given her something that would just knocked her out and she slept for 12 hours. He wants to humiliate her. He wants her to be stuck on the privy, you know? And, you know, we already talked about how he humiliates Alistair Thorne, you know, partly out of revenge, but also to save face himself in court.
And now he's humiliating Pycelle.
And now he's humiliating Pycelle, right? Because he tells, you know, Shaga, cut off his manhood.
Right.
And of course, the
and making we think him sort of stand naked, and then he gets his beard chopped off, and
which for a maester is right huge, right? You know, because you know a beard, it's not a you know the symbol is the chains that's the actual symbol, but having a long beard is also again the sign of age and wisdom and so on, and so he's being removed of his manhood, qua maester, not his literal manhood as we think of it, but.
So, all right. Yeah, all right. So he does this to Pycelle. And then, of course, I mean, there's a sense in which the axe that chops off the beard is maybe a foreshadowing of what happens to Tyrion's face. Mm. Because, you know, Martin loves these sort of poetic justice motifs. Like mm-hmm. like Jamie pushes a child out the window with a hand, he gets that hand chopped off. So maybe Tyrion chops off Pycelle's, you know, something that's growing from his face, right? and, you know, done to humiliate, basically. Unnecessary. And Tyrion ends up getting his nose chopped off by an axe. Maybe that's a little bit of sort of in-world justice.
No, I think that makes perfect sense. Yeah, having those types of, again, sort of karmic outcomes. And also, yeah, just poetic callbacks. It kind of reminds me, again, of, you know, invoke another genre, you know, Lucas with Star Wars. You know, sometimes people complain that you look at the three trilogies, it's like the same story being told three times. And Lucas is like, yeah, that's the point. these stories are thematic. And it also shows that
the hero's journey is circular, right?
The hero's journey is circular. And, you know, the human drama is always a human drama. And, you know, raises this question. And this is a question also for Song of Ice and Fire. You know, can you break the cycle? Mm-hmm. What does it take to break the cycle? Otherwise, what, you know, we've seen, you know, way back during the age of the Targaryens is going to be no different. You know, it's no different with Robert in charge. It's going to be no different if Cersei, you know, the Lannisters ascend the Iron Throne. And, you know, maybe it'll be no different if the Targaryens, through Daenerys, retake down. It's just the same pattern over again. So how do you break the pattern?
You know, Jason, that reminds me of a good book about Star Wars and philosophy. would you mind sharing the title and the topic?
Yeah. So my good friend, Kevin Decker, and I have recently published our third edited collection of essays written by philosophers, mostly philosophers, a few other types of academics in there, on philosophical themes in Star Wars. So the first book was called Star Wars and Philosophy, More Powerful Than You Can Possibly Imagine. Then several years later, we did The Ultimate Star Wars and Philosophy, which I'm blanking with the subtitle. Oh, You Must Unlearn What You Have Learned. And now in last February, we published Star Wars and Philosophy Strikes Back. This is the Way.
Okay, interesting.
And yeah, each book is a collection of essays on, again, all sorts of various philosophical themes on Star Wars, from not just the films, but also the television shows, comic books, the animated series. There's even a whole essay on the blue Snaggletooth action figure.
So Decker and Eberl, Star Wars and Philosophy, Strike Back.
Yep. Yeah. Available on Amazon or your favorite independent bookseller.
Notable introductions in this chapter. No notable introductions that I could tell. Departures. All of Cersei's guard departs in this chapter. Mm-hmm. I'm sure Thorne goes back to the wall, and goodbye to Maester Pycelle's beard.
R.I.P.
That's right. It'll grow back. Differences with the show. Littlefinger does use the line, leave me out of your next deception, but the setting is different. This doesn't happen at court. This sort of happens in Tyrion, Solar, and immediately Tyrion does involve Littlefinger in his next deception. And so basically this chapter ends with so almost a bit of enmity between Littlefinger and Tyrion. Tyrion looks at the knife on, you know, the Valyrian steel knife on the belt of Peter Baelish, and almost gets a sense of like, ah, I got you back. It's a little bit of vengeance there. In the show, it's sort of like, yeah, let's still be allies, because there's a something greater to be gained. And I don't think that the plot to rescue Jaime made it into the show. In this chapter, the idea is that we're going to send a huge host up to escort Kleos Frey. And included in this host are three outlaws that are going to pretend to be soldiers, but they're going to actually rescue Jaime from his imprisonment. None of that happens in the show.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I definitely feel like in this season of the show, you do have a lot more conniving, let's say, between Peter Baelish, Littlefinger, and Varys.
Yeah, there's almost a rivalry, right? You see their dialogue, and almost all of the dialogue between Varys and Baelish is sort of show invention. But I like that aspect of the show. I like to sort of see them reveal bits and pieces of themselves to each other, almost as if they're sitting at the poker table.
Mm-hmm. And again, I think they have different end games. They're both using similar techniques. Well, they have like their own techniques, but I think they're equally skillful at manipulating other people and using deception, whether it's outright lies or withholding of truths, in ways. But I think they're aiming at different things.
They're playing the same game, and yet the win for Varys would be something like, let's get someone altruistic on the Iron Throne, or let's cause the least amount of bloodshed in the kingdom, or something along those lines. Baelish is like, let's create a massive amount of chaos and see who can navigate it best. And it's probably going to be me. I'll have more power when it's over, and that will be the best outcome to my mind. And I think you've got probably Tyrion somewhere sort of maybe being tempted by, you know, an angel on one shoulder and a devil on the other or something like that.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, I think it definitely, I mean, throughout the story, but at this point in particular, I think the three of them, they're kind of the triumvirate of, you know, talk about friendship of utility, mm-hmm. right? That they're kind of a little triangle of utility friends, each with their own purpose. And I think also definitely they're the best ones at playing the game.
This book is perfect. I mean, you Game of Thrones was the name of the first book. This one really showcases the game, I think.
Yes.
Can we run through a few things? There's a few things I want to mention.
Yeah, yeah.
And I just want to hear your take on it really quickly. So what I've got. One question about Tyrion and one question about Bronn. Firstly, Tyrion keeps going back to Shae and keeps going back to his initial love, who was a prostitute. And
Tysha,
I'm really
conflicted.
Yeah. Tysha, right. I'm really conflicted as to what Tyrion's perception of women is. Like, do you think he sort of has respect for these women, that he's trying to, you know, he's kind of like defending the poor woman whose child was killed, and I can't tell if he has any regard for women at all, any respect for them, or if it's just an act. I can't really tell. What do you think?
It's interesting. I don't know if Tysha was a prostitute, and honestly I don't know if Shay's a prostitute either. Shay, I'm not sure when she becomes a spy for Tywin, so I'm not really sure about that. But in either case, Tyrion has perceived them both to be sex workers, right? And he asked this question out loud, almost kind of in spite of himself. He says, can a whore really love anyone? And then he says, don't answer that. I don't really want to know. And I do think that there's a little moment where he kind of exposes his true self. I think that Tyrion does wonder whether or not someone who you're paying for love will actually truly love you. But he is more committed to the lie than anything else. He wants to continually self-deceive. He needs to believe the lie because it gives him a feeling of normalcy. And he's great at certain things and he's not good at other things, but really what he really wants deep down is to feel like a normal person. He wants to feel like a human, and he has a view of what that looks like, and it doesn't look like him. And so the fact that he believes that Shay loves him, even though he knows that might be something that he's deceiving himself about, It provides him with a sense of normalcy. And so he's using Shay. He's using Shay for his own self-worth.
Okay.
What do you think?
I think Tyrion is a bit of a pick-me boy, as we would call them in the world of TikTok.
Wait, say that again. I'm not in the world of TikTok.
A pick-me boy. So these are men who will act like they speak for the plight of women.
Oh.
In fact, they only do it to kind of get women to like them.
Did you say pick-me boy?
Yes. So,
they want the women to pick them?
Yeah, so this is the born out of this theory that there is such a thing as a pick-me girl and a pick-me boy. The pick-me girls, they tend to hang out with the boys and say, oh, girls are so...
I'd rather hang out with the boys.
And the pick-me boy, his strategy technically genuinely is to be like, oh, I think women should be treated well and everything, but actually he's just doing it to...
This is all subterfuge. He's not a legit feminist.
Exactly.
Interesting.
We have a sense that he cares about women. He doesn't like want to look down on them. But actually, I think accents speak louder than words. I think he has absolutely no regard for women at all.
Interesting.
And he only respects men. And I think we have evidence of that in the way that he treats women in his life.
Well, it would make a lot more sense of some of his more darker moments, right?
I think when he sends Mycella to Dawn, I don't think he'd do that with her. I think he genuinely sees women as currency.
Yeah.
I think that's a point of contention that he doesn't understand about his sister, is that his sister, right, there's a lot of people comparing Cersei and Arya, right? These are women who are born women, but actually, Cersei says in this book at one point, right, Jaime was given a sword and he was taught how to fight, but I wasn't. That's not fair. We looked identical.
Yeah, right.
And I think Tyrion completely misunderstands that about his sister, because I think he has no regard for the plight of women. And I think if he did, they could get along better, because really what Cersei is seeking is she's seeking to get the respect that a man gets.
It's interesting. Well, she's also bullied him, right, his whole life.
Yes.
But your point is that this is kind of, we've seen this in lots of different relationships with Tyrion and women. Like he doesn't really respect Penny when he meets Penny. You know, he ends up murdering Shay. I'm trying to think of other examples with Tyrion and women. I think we have not seen Tyrion.
He respects Sansa.
What's that?
He treats Sansa well.
Yeah, but even then, he's so much her senior that he can kind of lord it over her. Even
true.
I'm wondering, we have not seen him yet with Dany, but I'm hoping that he does learn to respect and try to serve Dany well, which would be a departure for his character, right?
Yes, I think for sure that would be a departure. That would be quite surprising.
Yeah, interesting.